Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Initech.
No, you're working at Initech because that question is bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million...
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world, and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Oh, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
If I had $1 million.
Well, and welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tamara Andrew on the board. S&P futures down 33. NASDAQ futures down 123. After a kind of a strange day yesterday, we had NVIDIA way up as everybody just can't get enough of it. Yet everything else felt pretty good. So we had a kind of a very bifurcated market. We had the Dow down a bunch. We had, since I'm saying it, I'll give it to everybody exactly. Dow was down 216. The S&P was up 1 and NASDAQ was up 99, mostly NVIDIA. But a lot of the rest of the stuff was down a real lot, then came back on the close because we had a pretty lousy Treasury auction with the 10-year went out at 4.54, which is a big move up. We'll see if that continues today. That's not good. Evidently, they had a 7-year or something else yesterday. They had two in a row, and the auction did not go well. So kind of shook the market in the afternoon. But then again, doesn't matter where these interest rates go, it doesn't appear. It's a buy the dip. Do we have Mr. Kevin?
Yes, speaking of dips, right?
No, I didn't say that. You know,
I read it. I could hear it in your voice.
There was a gentleman on the trading floor, a broker. He actually had an acronym of DIP.
And now, it stood for?
The dip. What do you think he was called for all the year he was there? The dipster.
The dipster. All right.
You know, I mean, why would anybody sort of pick that acronym? One of my buddies I played golf with and so forth, I still talk to him, SCM. He was known forever as Scummy. That's not a good
scummy.
One either.
That would be a good one, sure.
Yeah, yeah. So there were a few. There was the best is shows you how crazy people are. There was a guy, his acronym was SAM, right? He was a broker. And the whole world called the guy Sam, right? So I'm chairman of the membership committee 1 year, and everybody applies to be on your committee, and then you pick the people you want. You know, it's very, kind of, and it's sort of like a,
it's a democratic draft.
Pretty much. But you know what? The thing of it is, on a membership committee, we would actually, more than people need to know, I suppose, but if somebody applied to be a member, you know, they had to fill out all this stuff, and people did a little bit of an investigation and all this stuff, and every single person was essentially examined by a member. So, of course, there was a lady, Judy Deal, absolutely spectacular lady, was the head of the membership department at the CBOE. I mean, she and I were real tight. She called me, she goes, all right, Tom, we've got, you know, 22 applicants. Why don't you come on up? She goes, these two or three are real tough. So I'd go in the other room and I'd go through all of them, the ones that were tough, and then I would assign them to my best people, you know, on the committee that had most experience. And then the people that were kind of a layup, the new people on the committee. But everybody was expected to give a report on the person that they looked at and a recommendation. And they, I don't think they ever figured out that on the tough ones, I had already gone through them all, right? I mean, this is just basic management, as I'm sure you would teach in your class. So I'd always have just randomly certain people always got the tough ones, right? I don't know if anybody figured that out either, but it worked amazingly well. And so anyway, this guy applies for the committee, and I just go through. I don't pick him. He says, hey, Tom, how come you didn't pick me? I said, what are you talking about? You didn't even apply. Turns out the guy whose name was John, not Sam. I had no idea.
You didn't know him, so you only knew him as Sam, huh?
Yeah, well, the whole world just knew him as Sam. I had no idea the guy's name was John. So then, get a load of this, Kevin. Talk about a bunch of old farts knocking them off their I don't know, whatever you want to call it, their comfortable rocking chair. All the committee chairmen would, they'd come to the board, they would formally approve everybody on the committee that everybody had picked, right? So, of course, I felt so bad about this that the next board meeting, I brought his name in and said, I'd like to add somebody to my committee. And one of the outside board guys is a total, you know, just vote whatever everybody else, the place wanted. He greets this with outrage. What are you talking about? How can you do such a thing? And I just said, you know, I didn't realize the guy's name was John. I'd already told him I was going to be on the, he could be on the committee, and I just screwed up, and it's one guy. What's the difference? This is so irregular. This is so irregular. I can't believe we're doing this. I'm getting really teed off, but it was in a board setting, so of course I'm trying my best to douse cold water on my Irish temper. And I'm like, the thing barely passed. What, you guys have nothing better to do? What is the matter with you idiots? But anyway, I digress.
Just well, you do have, there is a mindset always that rules are rules, damn it, and they should never ever be bent or broken. And, you know, I mean, that's not unusual. That's not unusual to encounter that. So, you know, you did.
Yeah, I did.
I don't know what else to tell you. Is you know, you ran up against that mindset, and you know, those, the people who feel that way can be, you know, they can keep you honest. So it's not an awful thing to encounter, but damn, it's a pain in the butt to deal with.
You know, I never even understood it, the temper blood was flowing, but I didn't crack. I just hung with it until finally enough people said, well, just this one time, you know, well, let's not just be a regular, shut up and let's just vote, will you? Oh, my God. Anyway.
Don't make a habit of it.
Whatever. So as soon as I won, I'm sitting there going, I can't handle these guys, but that was it. But hey, we got all kinds of stuff to talk about. We should probably talk about Bill Walton for a minute, but then I want to talk about this NCAA settlement thing. I've been reading about this, Kevin, and I cannot find out who the hell's who in here and who even started the damn thing and how they could even sue for back pay when there is no pay. I'm totally mystified by this thing. Why?
Well, we can talk about that, but let's talk about Bill Walton.
Yeah.
See, Bill Walton was fun.
He was just, you know, a good guy.
We remember him from college days. We were all at the rather famous ending of the 88-game winning streak that UCLA had. And so we probably all shouted a few things at Bill Walton that weren't very nice. Did you go to the game back when you were, probably a freshman when they lost before they went on the 88?
I did not, because that was on break.
Oh, okay. I was there. Yeah, my brother got me tickets to that game for Christmas.
Yeah, because we were home. I mean, the whole school,
So people don't know that. A lot of people, college basketball fans, remember that Notre Dame ended their winning streak, but they don't realize that Notre Dame bookended their winning streak.
Well, that was Austin Carr, and he was some kind of player.
Yeah,
I'm going to say he was the best player I ever saw in college.
That I've seen in person.
Yeah. And I got to see him every night.
Trying to think of who else would even challenge for that I've seen in person.
But I got to see him every night, you know, which was really something. I mean, my freshman year, I'm like, God, I get to go see Austin Carr. You know where I spotted that guy? He was, the Irish had this old, crummy old field house, and they were building this new convocation center, and they were trying to get, you know, they didn't think they could fill it up just by South Bend people. So they actually did sort of a road tour, and they played a game at Marist High School, and where I went to high school. So my stepfather says, well, let's go to the game. So we go up there. It was essentially a scrimmage.
Mm-hmm.
And they're playing, and there's this one guy. I said to my stepfather, who is that guy? He stood out so much among everybody else as Austin Carr. It was like a man among boys. And I'm like who's that dude? And that was the Austin Carr. the get a load of this. This is
and there's a good story from that game against UCLA.
Yeah.
Where, nobody could stop him. Carr scored, I don't know, 42, 44 points, something like that. It was before three-point shot days, otherwise it would have been 52. And Carr, it was an incredible scorer. He still owns like five of the top 10 scoring games in NCAA tournament history, including the number one and number three.
Without a three-point line.
Without a three-point line. So finally John Wooden gets around to putting Sidney Wicks on him. Nobody else can cover him, and so he puts Sidney Wicks on him. And you can go find the old Sports Illustrated article that sort of cleaned up the language on it.
Wait for a second, Kevin.
Wicks, it was like two trips down the floor, and Carr blew by him one time, and then so he tried to back off of him, and then so Carr just stopped and popped in a jumper, and running back down the court, Sidney Wicks looks at John Wooden and says, "I told you I couldn't bleepin' guard him."
Yeah. Well, yeah, Carr had the ability. When you see these people when they grow older, like him and even Adrian Dantley is the same way, they're really huge men. They're bigger and stronger. When I say you look at a guard in college in those days, might be 6'2". But a lot of the guys are 175 pounds. Then you'll see a guy who's 198 or 205, and he's all muscle. The difference is dramatic. I mean, if you ever, you don't realize what a few pounds can do. I'm not talking about a big fatso, a few pounds. If ever you want to see a difference in weights, go to see like a Golden Gloves or something, where you see the guys walking by, the fighters that are 125, and then you'll see the guy who's 132. None of them have an ounce of fat on them. The difference the 7 or 10 pounds makes is dramatic. And Austin Carr had the ability to blow around people, but he also had enough bodily bulk before, he wasn't like, the round mound or rebound. It wasn't like Charles or anybody like that. But he could kind of lean into somebody and then jump back pretty high with the ball over his head. And I don't care if you were 7'8", you couldn't block the shot. I don't care how strong, because I could never jump. I don't care how much of a jumper you are. If you've got bodily contact with somebody, they can't jump, right, Kevin?
It is hard, yes.
So if they're leaning on you.
I will say this for you, Tom, though. At least your vertical has not increased as you've got, or decreased as you've got.
Oh, without a doubt. It would have been a quick move for somebody to slide some tissue paper under those heels. Anyway, but Bill Walton, I've never. Kevin, I don't like, I'm not into music like some of the rest of our guys, but I never really got onto this Grateful Dead thing. But boy, a lot of people sure as hell did. And I remember a concert here the last time they played in Chicago when the one guy was still alive. Underneath, it was a weekend. It had to be 90s the whole weekend. And underneath the railroad tracks over here, there's a parking spot. And I drive by it. I came down to work on a Sunday, and I see all these microbuses. Like from the 60s and 70s, how they had the thing still running. Those things are real valuable if you can find one. There had to be like 15 of them in there, and all these old hippies are in these things, and I didn't see a men's room, I didn't see a shower, and I'm going, it's got to be pretty grody in there. But these people just did that. They went from, weren't all the concerts the same? I mean, why would you want to see like five in a row? I mean, I never got into that.
First of all, they weren't all the same.
Okay.
They were very improvisational. Their set list changed regularly. So you had that going on. That was a big part of it. I don't know. I've saw them a number of times. So
I do have a whole bunch of Jerry Garcia ties, though. I love them.
Okay, well, there you go.
But Bill Walton was a massive.
Get something out of the experience too.
Yeah. So Bill Walton was a massive Deadhead. Didn't he take all the guys on Boston to a Grateful Dead concert? They all loved it. Larry Bird and all those guys.
Yeah, this is the the stories that you get about Bill Walton that everybody is telling, sharing, and so on this week. It's incredible the number of people who just have really good Grateful Dead Bill Walton stories, and they all kind of theme out the same way. Very beloved, very. Humorous, fun, So, you know, and I've enjoyed Bill Walton as a commentator, you know, a little bit. There were times when I think he could be a bit much, but in general, I have enjoyed Walton as a commentator because I think he's just hilarious. But he was a guy who just really enjoyed, you know, life in general, and made it a point, just made it a point to enjoy life and to be a bright spot for people. And I think that's pretty cool. He was also one hell of a basketball
player. Oh, God, yeah.
When Portland won it, when he was their center, I mean, first of all, I can't remember, you know, maybe Wes Unseld would trigger a break like Walton could. You know, just
yeah, Wes also was 6'7", but he was built like a bleep.
Built like a tank. Yeah. So you know, you're looking at that kind of a player. He was a great passer out of the post, high or low, and a pretty darn good scorer to go with it. So heck of a basketball player, had a lot of physical ailments that shortened his career.
Well, if you're a big guy and you break one of those foot bones, you're good for like a long time. That's what happened to Yao Ming. That's what happened to a lot of people.
That's a problem. But, you know, really a joy to watch play basketball. A lot of fun to listen to him do a game. He worked a lot with Jason Benetti, who up until this year had been the White Sox play-by-play guy. And Benetti had some fun stories about him yesterday. I think it's just fun when you get people like that that everybody seems to love. I have not seen anybody, you know, huffing about something that they didn't like about Bill Walton.
I got a story for you though. Which doesn't mean I don't like him. When he was in college, I think he might have stuttered a little, but he was pretty protected from the press.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, pretty seriously. I mean, he was never really in an interview or anything. And so finally, one day, he decides to give an interview, or somebody did. So somebody gives him, remember, I used to watch Channel 2 News every night. I think it was Bruce Roberts. Remember him? And they had, you know, John Daly and those guys who, there's another guy, John Daly. What a terrific guy he was. He played serious football for some place, and he died of ALS, too. Remember Flynn Daily News, the younger guy, John Daly? Anyway, so they play this video of the interview. So there's Bill. He's sitting on a rock out in, like, you know, the desert with the blue jeans, with the, you know, the open knees and the tie-dyed shirt, and he's got the bandana around his head. And he's giving this interview. And he's like, you could have sworn, Kevin, he just did like five dubs. Before the interview, and they, yeah, man, you know, and I really love basketball. It's like really cool, you know, when you give an outlet pass and somebody scores. So they do this interview, and they cut back to the newsroom. And this is back before anybody ever said anything bad about anybody, and so they're just sitting there, and nobody said anything. And finally, John Daly goes, "He sure moves quicker to the hoop, doesn't he?" The whole newsroom just breaks out laughing. I don't think I've ever seen that on the news before or since. But there was nothing bad about him. He just, you know, he must have doomed up for his first interview or something.
Probably did. Now, the other thing is, he was a huge fan of Artis Gilmore. He thought Gilmore, the hardest guy, you know, playing against Artis Gilmore was the biggest challenge that he would have every year. And they of course knocked the Bulls out of the playoffs en route to their championship. So
well, you
know, it was sort of high praise there.
If you've never played any sports, there's people that are considered the greatest and all this other kind of stuff. But depending on your skill set, there's always somebody who's something up your butt, right? They just have a skill set that you don't quite match up against. I mean, when I was pitching in softball, I hated the guys who just reached up and slapped the ball. You know, their skill set was to not hit it. My skill set as a pitcher was always trying to frustrate the people trying to hit it really, really deep. And the other guys just killed me. You know, they didn't care. They just slapped it. But Artis Gilmore was a massive man. I mean, he probably was, after Wilt, I'm going to say he might have been one of the strongest guys that ever played. Bob Lanier maybe, you know, but he was a huge guy, and I could see where Bill was just outweighed and outstrength, and Artis just never left them around the basket. And I would say that would be a really rough night for Bill Walton, even though Bill Walton, I think, was a better player.
Yeah, and not just the strength, too, but Artis Gilmore was an incredibly tough man.
Yeah.
You know, you could beat the crap out of him. It didn't matter. He wasn't very vocal. He wasn't any of that kind of stuff. But he took it. He dished it out. It didn't matter. He was not going to back down from anybody.
Well, and those guys, I remember one night the Bulls were playing the Lakers, and Chet Walker, who had been a teammate of Wilt's, matter of fact, the old basketball fans would say the greatest team ever put together was the Philadelphia team that beat the Celtics the one year. And it was Wilt, it was Chet Walker, who was a standout. It was Gus Johnson, who was one of the first of the tear the rims off kind of guy. Remember, he was just a powerful power forward. And Hal Greer, who was, I think, a Hall of Famer. And I forget, was it Wally Jones was the other? There are old basketball guys that would say that those five guys or that year was the greatest team ever. And they beat the Celtics one of the years. And so the Bulls are playing, I think it was the Lakers. So Wilt gets the ball inside, and he starts to go up for a slam. And Chet hit him so hard across the forearms, he knocked the ball out of Wilt's hand. A regular person would have been in a hospital. And Wilt just shrugged it off, went to the free throw line. Well, that's what Chet needed to do to get me to stop me for that dunk. It's okay. Okay. God, it was an assault. But, I mean, the man is so big, it didn't even bother him. You know, I mean, an artist was almost that big, almost that strong. He might have been the second strongest guy I ever saw. I mean, Bob Lanier was a big man, too, but... You know, those guys were, you don't see those kind of people walking down the street. I mean, you just don't. I mean, but anyway, RIP Bill Walton, we will miss you. I had not noticed that he had not done a game since February, Kevin. Remember the last game he did, I must have listened to, because all he was talking about was how upset he was that they were breaking up the Pac-10. It was a conference, I mean, that was his conference. I mean, he really loved it. Didn't he do college ball for the conference there for how many years, for God's sake?
Well, yeah, he was doing, I mean, he was doing ESPN. He was working for ESPN, but, because he lived out on the coast, he did a whole lot of games from, as he used to love to call it, the Conference of Champions.
Well, Kevin, we're going to break and we'll get back.
I did seize the moment this week to go buy myself a Pac-12 t-shirt, so that's on that got shipped yesterday.
I might have to grab a hat. S&P futures up 35, NASDAQ futures up 140. You're right back, Stocks and Jocks. I'm sorry, down 135 and down 140.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to gauge the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other decision. And Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with relevant trade ideas, and equips you with cutting-edge tactics you don't already know. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on pursuing life, luxury, and happiness through sports, fitness, travel, food, spirits, music, and a whole lot more. Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Is your business being challenged by the complexities surrounding healthcare reform or other matters related to human resources management? If so, then Cognos HR can help. A longtime friend and contributor to the Stocks and Jocks radio program, Cognos HR provides its clients with a perfect blend of strategic consulting and day-to-day HR management to drive overall improvement in business performance. Companies that join the Cognos HR family are better able to manage healthcare costs, enhance benefit offerings, and improve employee satisfaction by leveraging our access to Fortune 500 benefits. Our innovative onboarding and payroll technology, along with our constant attention to detail, enables us to provide the highest level of quality service to our clients. Now, your time and energy can be focused on generating business and increasing your bottom line. We'll take care of the rest. For more information, call us at 630-401-8810 or search us on the web at CognosHR.com. Cognos HR, Innovation in Human Resources. Licensed in Illinois and Arizona.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here.
Hello and welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Andrew on the board. SP Futures down 34, NASDAQ Futures down 132. I'm going to run through these numbers here today, but be careful here. I'm not just running through a bunch of numbers today. There's some real significant moves here that have happened in the bond area, and I think everybody, I'm not saying it's tradable or anything like that, but we should really pay attention here. S&P Futures down 34, NASDAQ Futures down 133. Individual stocks, I don't have that much move. NVIDIA's up again, of course. That's trading 11.42. I've got Meta down almost $5, 4.92. Microsoft down 3.60. Tesla down 2.05. Dow's down 2.57. These are the futures. Over in Asia, we got the Nikkei down 298.8%. Hang Seng down 344, 1.8%. The 19,000 is it's in somebody's mind now. 18,477. Shanghai, however, is up a buck. Call that flat. Over in Europe, we've got the DAX down 132.7%, FTSE down 25.3%, CAC around down 87, that's over 1%, 1.1%. Yesterday in the U.S., I said we had this wacky day. We were up, then we were down on the bad auction, and we came back on the close. The buy dippers don't seem to watch the news, but they came in and bought. Dow was down 216, S&P up 1, NASDAQ up 99. Most of that was NVIDIA. Bonds, now here's the chiller. 30-year bonds, 4.68%. We're talking 4.2 a few days ago. So we're pushing towards 5%. That's up 3 basis points. The Bund up 5 basis points, 2.63. Now, this is the Kevin, keep your eye on this one. Japan up 1.12. I've been talking for how long it's taken Japan to get from 0 to 1%. They're up 1.12% in a day, to 2.20. The significance of that is Japanese government debt is $9.2 trillion. It's 263% of their GDP. 43% of it is held by the Bank of Japan. So they just went up 1%, $200 billion in interest in one day for their government to pay. Their government's not as big as ours. That is a problem. Matter of fact, it's a big problem. We've got oil up 67 cents, 80.50, back above 80. Brent up 65 cents, 84.87, as the Saudis are going to try and major producers are trying to keep these output cuts in place, but every time they say something, we rally up a little bit, we come right back down. We'll see if that happens this time. Natural gas down 4 cents, RBOB unchanged at 251. Gold, which had a huge rally yesterday, is down 11 bucks today. 2368, it almost made it to 2400 yesterday. We'll see if this little sell-off holds. Silver, which was up 4% yesterday, is actually down 2 cents today, but it's not much. It was up over a dollar yesterday, which is a huge move. U.S. dollar, the yen, of course, hitting a four-week low, like we just talked about. The euro dips after the German inflation data. So the euro is 108, didn't dip very much. It's right about where it was. And the pound's 127. So very slight strength in the dollar this morning. We have crypto is down 490, 67,797. A little long-winded there, Andrew, but a lot of stuff happening. What do you got for us, traffic, weather, sports?
All righty. It is 6:35 here in Chicago on Wednesday, May 29th. There's a little bit of sports here, a mix of some good and some bad. The Cubs won over the Brewers 6-3, while the White Sox lost to the Blue Jays 7-2, and the Diamondbacks lost to the Rangers 4-2. Over in Chicago weather, it's kind of the same mix, good and bad. We're still going to be a little bit rainy and gross throughout the morning. We get some mostly cloudy skies throughout the day. We're going to have a high of 62 degrees. That's going to hit around 4 p.m. We are currently standing at about 56 degrees. Over in Phoenix, they are always looking a lot better than we're looking over here. They're currently at 78 degrees. They got clear skies. They're going to have a high of 101, and that's going to hit around 5 p.m. as well. Finally, for Chicago traffic, not too many major accidents to report. I would say none at all on the major expressways. If you're coming in on the inbound, expect some delays from nearly every major expressway. If you're on the outbound, look out on the Eisenhower just near Central Avenue. Things are slowing down a little bit out there, but not too bad compared to how they usually are. So that is all I got. Back to you, Chief.
Kevin, what do you make of these interest rate moves, bud, before we get into the other stuff? This Japan thing is...
Does this mean no rate cut this summer?
I'm going to say yeah. I mean, but I mean, just trying to get a historic.
Does this mean we're not having six this year? Is that what that means?
I don't know. I'm just looking at the Japanese 10-year. Well, these guys got it. This other graph's got it up 0.04. I wonder. Anyway, it's I want to make sure on that, but they don't change that. That isn't wrong what I just said. I don't think it is, but even at 1.12, where this other graph's got it, this must be a graph from yesterday. You have to go back, Kevin, to what did I say yesterday? You got to go back to 1.12 6 June of 2011 is the last time. I mean, if it really is at 2, if they're up 1%, which I guess I better make sure of that before I talk about it too much more, even though that's what it says here on CNBC. You have to go back to where are we? I'm going to say wait. I'm going to go back to what's the date here? 10/10/98. That's a ways.
Yeah, that's a little ways off.
Yeah, to get to a 2% number. That's all right, Kev. This settlement came out. For those that don't know, a settlement came out regarding the NCAA. It's called House versus NCAA. Is House one of the original class members? Who the hell is House?
Yeah. He was an Arizona State swimmer, Grant House, and he and an Oregon women's basketball player named Sedona Prince, who I believe is now at TCU, going to play her final year at Texas Christian. They sued the Power Five conferences, and it became a class action suit, and it was over antitrust violations. Now, this was right before all the name, image, and likeness stuff and that particular Supreme Court decision. And actually, the law firm that filed it is the same law firm that drove the rest of it too. So that, you know, they're very involved in this. What they were after, what House's problem as a swimmer was, he wanted to go to the Olympics, and he was having his name, image, and likeness rights curtailed at that point, and that it inhibited his ability to raise money to train for the Olympics and, you know, take a year off of school, train for the Olympics, and yet he would lose his college eligibility if he did, and put him at a competitive disadvantage. So that was his practical, you know, as a practical matter, was his problem. Prince's was, you know, regarding transfer rules. She had problems when she was at Texas. She had problems at Texas that were disagreements with the medical staff and her medical treatment, and she wanted to be able to transfer to Oregon without having to sit out a season. So these were the issues. If we remember those days long ago and far away, like 5 years ago, that were sticking in the craw of college athletes, but that's what was going on.
Kevin, it got real bad. You're on a roll here, so I'm going to interject real quickly. One of my buddies, I think you maybe have met him, but his niece was a soccer goalie, right? And she walks on at Illinois. She's got no ride. She walks on. She's really pretty good. I don't know if the regular goalie, the scholarship goalie, either got nicked a little bit or she just got beat out. She ended up starting like the whole second half of the year. They never gave her a ride and been brought in some high school hotshot goalie that they gave a ride to. She said, well, I want to transfer. They wouldn't let her transfer. They can, in those days before there was a transfer portal, the school could give you a dispensation. It's not like I'm in the church. Whatever they want. A waiver or something. They refused to give her the waiver. She wasn't even on scholarship. That's how bad so many schools were about this stuff. Anyway, go ahead. Go on. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yeah. So anyway, they finally have reached a settlement on it. They were going to prevail, and this is kind of retro to the reason it's retro to 2016 is because that's what retro for Grant House is. Okay, so it's you know, when I first saw this, why is the cutoff 2016? Well, it's 2016 because the original plaintiff wanted to reach back that far. So that's how that happened.
Okay, Kevin, my next question, well, I got a million of them here, but I'm reading this article here. Not only does the settlement distribute roughly $2.8 billion in NIL back pay, that sentence has to, I'm going to say, how can I say this? It seems to me that sentence has to be wrong. I mean, the people who were harmed by the name, image, and likeness were people, even like Jen's brother, I mean, a long time ago, long time ago, where they wouldn't let him model like flannel shirts for Kohl's during the summer. I mean, that's where I would have expected these kinds of lawsuits to land. How do you go from there to actually back pay by the university when they never paid anybody?
Well, they didn't, but they blocked the ability to earn.
I'm saying that I would get.
In violation of antitrust law, so that's what they're saying.
Okay, but I know I'm splitting hairs here, Kevin, but if I'm a very loquacious, good-looking dude and somebody wants me to do, you know, whatever, baseball games in the fall for the university and they say, no, you can't do that, or if I'm an attractive or personality young lady who wants to be a model or whatever, wants to be in a play or whatever it is during the summer, she might be a drama major, and they block me from doing that, I can see how that is the absolute spirit of the name, image, and likeness. And I could sue and say I could have made, you know, $10,000 for this play last summer. You wouldn't let me do it. By the way, you owe me $10,000. I can get that part. I don't see how that advances to pay for being a volleyball player or pay for being a fat tackle on a football team. I don't get that.
Well, I don't think that it has. I don't know that it has definitely gotten to that yet.
Now, okay, so it may not. It all right.
But I sort of suspect it will, because as long as the schools and the conferences are going to be writing the checks, they might as well make them.
I'm not saying that they don't deserve it, but
I think ultimately you're going to find up there's going to be some kind of bargaining agent, whether it's a players' association, a union, you know, slash union. Or something that has to come out of this because of who has to, you know, because they have to distribute the money, and how it's going to be distributed, you know, is going to require some representation and negotiation amongst all of the athletes.
Well, let's try and I'm going to say we're going to try and piss away this $2.8 billion in legal fees in record time. Just saying.
Yeah, I mean, it very well could be.
But if it were me, I mean, based on the history, and again, I'm just trying to be a common sense Southsider. I'm not trying to be a lawyer because I know that's a whole. I'm not trying to do that. I'm saying for me, and there was all this money. I would zero in on people who had individual cases where you had a name, image, and likeness stuff for the last 10 years, 15 years, and you were not allowed to do it, where they actually did harm you from another livelihood, which has nothing to do with volleyball or football or swimming, and I don't see how they ever got away with that. But I would zero in on that, and I would also zero in on people that are paying for their own medical problems years later. That's the part about paying the athlete. I'd leave that one alone. I'd leave that one for the future.
They're not this is not going to be distributed on a cost basis. It's going to look at it the other way. One of the quotes in here that I have is a key this comes from Jim Booz, a former University of Virginia staffer who now serves as the director of college athletics advisory services at James Moore, which is a law firm, I believe. Anyway, says a key complexity is the fair value measurement of an athlete's NIL, which must be initially determined and regularly assessed. So I don't know if he means each individual athlete's NIL or the generically speaking an athlete's NIL. But one of the things that is a complicator here in terms of what that means is something that I never anticipated back when the Supreme Court made its decision. And that is these collectives that have been allowed to grow and become such a part of the landscape, because that is, you know, as far as I'm concerned, that is an arm's length arrangement that is essentially the same as having the athletes on the payroll. It's just, you know, they're laundering that circumstance through a third party. But, you know, I still think one of these days somebody's going to file a lawsuit there, like a comp claim or, something related to it. And we've even seen a few lawsuits that are, you know, we talked about one of these last week where the university is getting sued as well as the Name, Image, and Likeness Collective. When they initially made the ruling, what did we think would happen? That you would get your occasional Caitlin Clark who gets a big money deal, or or Williams getting his big money deals as the USC quarterback, somebody with a big personality and a tremendous amount of talent. But for the most part, that these would be small local deals. Well, along came these collectives, and they put together a lot of money that they're using to distribute to the athletes, essentially to overpay them, as far as I'm concerned. They're probably being paid way more than what their market value is worth for promotion. It might not be more than their market value is worth for playing the sport, and, you know, the revenue generated for the schools. But think of it like this. You know, how much does a Grunt Bears defensive tackle earn versus what Caleb Williams might earn, or what another star player might earn in terms of marketing revenue? Compare that to what the player earns as a salary. The salary is, you know, contribution to the team's success. The marketing value is something else that is, in the NFL, is handled on an individual basis. In college, that marketing value is, they get paid for their marketing value through a collective that is essentially saying, well, we're going to distribute, you know, how many million dollars to our football team this year. And that's, as far as I'm concerned, is a substitute salary, not real marketing value.
Well, it's
for an offensive lineman or some.
Well,
some,
but Kevin, player. And the based on the Supreme Court decision, that's I can see the guys in the trading
Supreme
floor.
Court decision just opened it up. The collectives came out of that. But
well, it's but yeah, but I'm saying
personally, I didn't anticipate such a thing as a collective.
Well, so. I would. To be perfectly blunt, I did. Like I said, I know there are people, because I knew a couple of them, that were drama majors that were football players that couldn't work in a play in the summer or in the fall or in the spring when they were.
I understand, yeah. that would be an individual's marketability.
I understand that, but what I'm saying is now the Supreme Court opens up this door. Well, they didn't open up narrow. And what are the people going to do? They're going
to
widen
their
the crack.
Their job to open it narrowly. Their job is to interpret what the law is.
But now I'm sitting there going, boy, I would really like to pay the offensive linemen at Notre Dame. These mopes don't realize it, but as a group, they are marketable. They are name, image, and likeness. They can go to a hospital at night and make kids feel better, right, if you want to go that route. Or they can be one night a week, they could go have a beer if they're 21 at Pete's Pizza and sign autographs, and they don't even know they're marketable. Guess what? I'm going to make them marketable. I'm going to be their collective agent. I'm going to collect money.
That doesn't surprise me, but what you just described, nothing that you just described is, you know, $500,000 marketable. It's not in a normal world. What they're doing is they're washing through those dollars as in basically it's a payroll.
Well, and then they're saying,
We're getting off the topic here, but so go ahead and make your point, and then I want to drive this back over to the original topic.
Right, and I guess what I'm trying to figure out is where exactly did these guys get the concept of back pay? Because there's been nothing in the Supreme Court thing even remotely refers to pay.
Yeah, that's why this is a separate lawsuit.
But, I mean, even these people...
When they say back pay, it's back, if I called it back earning power, would you feel better?
I think there's a huge difference.
Yeah, but... So, you know, I don't think there's anything in here that says back pay unless somebody wrote that in an article. And
well, that's what I'm looking at the article. You know, so
that would not necessarily be an accurate depiction of what.
You know, you're so far ahead of me half the time, it bothers me. Because I'm reading the article I sent you. It says in back pay. I'm reading the article, and my first thought is, I think this article is probably wrong. And so Kevin's going to tell me it's wrong, and you just did.
So you know, let's steer this back to this this particular decision then, because the reason I brought up collectives is that, you know, the NCAA is its own worst enemy now, because we've established, and they've allowed to be established, these collectives that that have now said there is an earning power for everybody on this team, and it's a big number. It's not the offensive lineman going down and hanging out at the pizza place, which is how, you know, some of these deals started to happen. It's not an appearance fee. It's not going, you know, it's not the rowing team going over to Dick's Sporting Goods and making an appearance in the spring when they're trying to sell boats. That's not what it is now. And at this point, it's this collective money. And so now when you're looking at settling out of this suit, you're settling it based on what has proven to be the earning power of the athletes, or their ability to earn from NIL, which is not, you know, it is not like market driven. It's salary. This is why I say it's a salary. It's already a salary. It's just a matter of who's paying it.
Well, but what's it for, Kevin? I mean, you know, the law can be split in a million different ways. I mean, you and I, if we had, we're two Daddy Warbucks. And we see a lot of lonely people in the veterans' homes, which we surely do, and that's what Di was in last week, a few weeks ago, talking about with the Fisher House. We could, if we wanted, Kevin, if we wanted to solve it, if we wanted to address that, we could put up money. We could even probably make a stab at making it a charitable contribution, and we could go pick up three or four people who are, maybe they have dogs, maybe they have something, and pay them, when I say dogs, I mean, you know, dogs that people like to hang around.
Therapy dogs.
Yeah, we could send those people for $400 an hour to the veterans' home two nights a week and pay them $2,000 a month. There's nothing that says we can't, so, right? But now these guys are doing it with essentially football players, right?
Yeah, they're doing it with football players, but they're not paying them $2,000 a month either. They're paying them a whole lot more.
Well, $600 an hour, I heard, which is a lot.
Yeah, something like that. So, you know, what the point being that, you know, that they've established this very, very high dollar amount of earning power for the athletes, and that factors into the settlement.
Yeah, and if there is such a thing as pay, but I just everybody who I've heard talk about this in the last few days, I can't imagine just somebody who was a swimmer or a girls or guys volleyball player from 2019 walking to his mailbox someday and getting a check, can you?
And yet that's where we are.
I think they're going to have to say that they were somehow harmed by the name, image, and likeness part of it.
Well, and that goes back to what, you know, what House's claim was.
Yeah.
That, you know, I'm an Olympic swimmer. Olympic swimmers are very marketable. You put me at a disadvantage if I can't market myself.
Well, he's going to have to say, I should have been an Olympic swimmer.
Olympic swimmers versus your average college swimmer might be, you know, might be a totally different issue. And that's why I go back to that quote I read you about, it's probably going to be determined to some degree on a case-by-case basis.
Well, that's what I'm saying, and
They're going to have to sift through all of that crap to figure out how to distribute all this money.
All right, so $2.8 billion divided by $600 an hour, or $650 or $700. I think half of it easy is going to be legal fees.
Well, the court will determine what the legal fees are. I've read anywhere from 20% to a third. So, you know, what it winds up being, I don't know.
Well, all right, let's go to the next paragraph. Sorry, because this article I'm reading here, and I don't think it's all that rigorous, but it's pretty interesting in terms of the winners and losers. How NCAA, which doesn't really make a dime off football, they don't make anything off the other stuff, do they? What does the NCAA make off of swimming or volleyball? Zero?
Very little. Very little, because the NCAA owns the championship structures for everything except football. So to the extent that, for instance, last weekend's lacrosse national championship weekend, to the extent that it made any money, which, you know, who knows if it did or not, they did have pretty good crowds in Philadelphia, so maybe they made a little bit of money. That would be part of their revenue stream. But essentially, the NCAA makes it almost all off of the men's basketball tournament.
Do they make any? I'm gonna say they probably do. But how much do you think they make off the World Series in Omaha? They can make some money there.
They probably make some, yeah.
But basically, yeah, it's the NCAA.
It's a matter of how much, because if you recall, I don't know what they charge for tickets there. It's well attended, so that's a good thing. So they get some revenue. They certainly have broadcast rights, which are pretty good, but they're not, you know, it's not like MLB broadcast rights or anything resembling it. So, what are we really looking at? And then, you know, they have to net out the expenses of being there. So there is, I think there's a decent chance that they make some money on that. But like I said, the big money, the huge deal is the men's basketball tournament. I'm kind of thinking the women's basketball tournament, from a TV rights standpoint, probably is their second biggest earner.
You know, Kevin, they got to be getting a spiff off the ESPN for all these bowl games, because they negotiate all that. They negotiate, every individual bowl doesn't negotiate their deal. The NCAA does, right? So they must be
actually, because ESPN tends to own the production rights to it. The NCAA does not own those.
So they don't get a dime out of the current 4-team playoff. They don't get a spiff on the tickets.
I'm sure they get something out of. They probably get something out of the playoff, but you know, even then, that's all designed around the bowl system. So you know, it's kind of this. It's why they have it done the way they do it. It is a way for them to sort of hog up the money for all the participants in the playoffs.
All right. So the NCAA is responsible for roughly 40% of the settlement. Much of the burden will fall on its member universities because they'll just tax them more. The power conference schools are poised to contribute roughly 24%, and leaving the often cash-strapped schools that comprise the remainder of Division I to cover the remaining 36%. Well, how in God's name is like Northern Illinois going to come up with money for this? They don't need dough.
That's a good question.
I mean, and how did they benefit from all this? Necessarily. I mean, if we got a dash here, Kevin. We'll talk more on Friday. But off the top of your head, if you look at all the money made in college football, and you look at the power conference schools, well, I'd look at the power conference schools probably plus Notre Dame. I have to believe out of all the money made, they must make 70% of it. How does this thing come out to where they're paying less than the other guys? But I could be wrong on that.
Yeah, what the deal is if you look at it, there's, I think, roughly 350 Division I schools. I mean, remember, this is covering all sports, not just football. So if you look at it from a participation standpoint, about 19% of the schools are power conference schools, and that's probably falling off a little bit depending on the final location of some of the Pac-12 schools. That may no longer be power conference schools. I don't know, there might be two or three of them. So it's not going to change the numbers significantly. So, you know, that's, you know, is it going to be shared in equal proportion? Is the expense going to be shared as part of, some kind of revenue model that does skew it more towards the power conference schools that have football? I don't know. I don't know what to think about that, but,
I'm going to see your lovely countenance this weekend. I'll bet you a beer that Texas and Alabama make more than the bottom 150 schools combined.
Well, they probably do. Not the point, though. If you're counting up how many of the power conference schools are comprise Division I, it's going to be less than 20% of them. Because there's about 350 Division I schools. They're not all playing Division I football. Division I football is about, you know, I think, roughly 120, 130, something like that.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
And Power Conference plus Notre Dame, I think you're talking 65. So, that's where the numbers are. So are you, you know, so when they look at this, are they saying that everybody in Division One is on the hook equally, or are they going to start telling us that that in fact some of the Division One schools will be more equal than others?
Well, that's what they're saying here. With the Power Conference, you just gave the numbers, are going to be 24%. When I say 24, the NCAA is paying 40. So out of the remaining 60, these guys are paying 24, which is two-fifths, and the other guys are paying three-fifths.
Yeah, I think it remains to be seen what that exactly how that's going to be negotiated.
Okay, but that seems to be one of the few numbers that actually came out of this thing, according to this guy. Anyway, on Friday, we got like the other 80% of the article, who's the winners and the losers, but here's one. I'll just lob in there before we bring John in. We got loser competitive balance, winner boosters and fan pocketbooks. You won't have to contribute as much. But this is the one here, big loser, non-revenue sports. I think all those scholarships go away. Winners, the lawyers. Loser, mid-level departmental bloat. I was stunned when I saw this, Kevin. You know more about this than me. For those that couldn't, this is, of course, this guy. I'll give you the guy's name who wrote the article. As of September 30 of 2023, Ohio State's Human Resources Database lists 139 athletic department employees with salaries exceeding $100,000.
How many? Oh yeah. And what I tell you?
Yeah.
I sent you Notre Dame's. The number of people with just titles. If you just look at the titles, let me see if I can pull it up. I mean, it's like way over 100 people with, you know, director, athletic assistant, athletic director, associate athletic director, and then, you know, what do we know about, you know, bowl game boondoggles and things like that? There is a lot of money. Look, you see this is true in any business. When the business is thriving, you start to see a whole lot of bloat creep in, and unless you manage it properly, eventually it comes back to bite you, and you wind up having to get rid of a lot of people. This is something I learned at a very young age in my business career, and have always made it a point not to have more people than I absolutely needed, to, you know, stretch a little bit on that, and to make damn sure that everybody else in the company knew that we weren't heavy. We didn't have any extra people. And, you know, do that all. I got that message out during the good times so that I didn't have to go cough up bodies in the bad times.
Cough up bodies on. There's a visual. Hey, well, Kevin, who was the school? Jan's probably already on. Who was the school that, just so you know, the history has been that if a school goes to the bowl, Notre Dame used to get all their money, but they don't anymore. But a conference, say, Missouri goes to the Orange Bowl or someplace, there's money that the school gets, and then they get, I guess they get their expenses get paid for as well, right, out of the bowl thing.
They get their expenses covered, but for the most part, the revenue all goes to the conference to be distributed amongst.
But I'm saying it the net
generally equally. There have been some conferences, at least in the past, who had a model that said, well, the team that actually played in that particular bowl game gets a little more than the than an equal share.
But what was the school, Kevin? This is, I'm going to say, a decade ago. Was it Colorado or somebody went to the Orange Bowl or went someplace, and their expenses ate up the entire revenue from the bowl to where the other teams got nothing? They brought so many people, they had so many martinis and shrimp cocktails that they blew the entire number. And then there was a big outrage, and then they put a limit on how much you could spend, like, the next year or something. But somebody pissed away all the dough one year, didn't they? You remember that?
I vaguely remember that, yeah. they take these gigantic entourages along, and it's just a big vacation for athletic department members and their families. And
boosters. They take boosters.
And some of their boosters, and some of, you know, it goes on and on and on. And this is not, you know, again, not a good way to run a business.
Now, just to be clear, are we pissed off because they did it, or are we pissed off because we weren't invited?
I personally pissed off because they did it, but but I can imagine some people being pissed off about not being invited.
Oh, I'm invited? Oh, this is the best use of money ever.
Yeah, it's an effective use of funds.
God.
It's called fundraising. It's good for the university.
Oh, God. Kevin, we'll continue this on Friday with other stuff. SP Futures down 31, NASDAQ Futures down 21. We'll have a very short break. We'll have Mr. Flanagan when we come back.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com. PTIProDirect.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
There's something happening here.
Hello and welcome to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Andrew on the board. S&P futures down 31. NASDAQ futures down 120. Kind of been here. Most of the morning. Do we have Mr. Flanagan?
You do, Tom. Good morning.
Good morning. I would hesitate. I would never want to describe you as mid-level department bloat.
I've probably been guilty at some point in my life.
Mid-level.
Maybe I was fully aware. Maybe I had no clue. But
where did the guy even get that? Mid-level department bloat. I like that.
Well, it applies to everything. I mean, not just, you know, sports programs, or, you know, university academic disciplines, but all the way through, you know, in the public sector and the private sector. And I think it's a good point, Tom, because, there's a reason why they settled the House NCAA case and didn't want to dare take it to trial, because I'm sure they thought that the impact would be, you know, hideous, from which they probably could never recover. If they really had to pay out through the nose. But I think this is just, it's delaying probably, the long-term benefit expiring on a lot of the mid-level bloat and everything else that the universities have gotten used to. And I think it may, take a little while, longer than if they had gone to trial probably and gotten a really big slap. But I just see that the bloom is off of this now, and I think it's going to really show what the cost of running these programs is. And there's going to be a lot of places that don't find it sustainable. They're going to lose a lot of people. They're going to lose a lot of recruiting in the process. But in the long run, they may think this can enable us to change our focus and concentrate on something else other than just feeding this beast. So. I don't know. I mean, I think it's they probably see it as some sort of a victory, but I think it's just staving off the inevitable.
Well, if you blow up college sports, which I don't think this is going to do, what are you going to do with Illinois deciding that they want to have a big chunk of their revenue now is going to be from sports gambling?
Well, and that I think just kind of hastens the decline too, because that's going to be a drain on attendance and everything. So I just see that's already happening, and you got enrollment declining too. So these universities don't really have the strongest, bargaining position anymore in this. And I think, the students are wise to it, the athletes are wise to it, but everything is going to change, I think, because of this. And it may take a while, but I think, in some ways college sports has had its day, and it's its own worst enemy maybe.
Boy, I don't know. You see all these people, the high schools are a factory for getting people scholarships. The AAU is doing that. All these travel teams, I mean, they're all doing that. So people go to college for free, right? I mean,
yeah, and like you said, I mean, that's going to, the cost associated with this is going to dry up a lot of scholarship money. I think it's going to postpone a lot of college plans for expansion of facilities or construction, which in the past is just, you know, just pick a number and we'll do it somehow, like what Northwestern's doing with, you know, Ryan Field. And I just don't think there's going to be the justification for that kind of, you know, continual growth.
At one point, I'm going to say, where are we, 2024? Maybe in 2020, I went back and did a, you know, seat of the pants study on how the expansion of the football stadiums in the top, like, 40 places. The numbers are astronomical. Of course, they don't pay near as much as a city does, because they actually get people to do it for the real price. I mean, when Michigan expanded their stuff for Ohio State, they didn't pay, you know, $5 billion like they're looking for a Bear Stadium. Where we
no, it's not like building anything with city money.
No, I mean, it's nothing like that. But, I mean, you look at the schools. I mean, Penn State, Texas A&M, Tulane has a new stadium, although they get less people. Notre Dame, it was a while ago. But every one of these places has done something to expand or do something. I mean, it's just, you know, every one of these. There's got to be how many places now. Andrew, do me a favor. Google the top 20 colleges that, in terms of seating capacity. There's got to be 12 of them now that are 100 or close to it. That wasn't like that 20 years ago. I mean, those are all expansions, I think.
And I'm sure there's a lot of others who think, you know, if only we could, you know, increase it by X factor or whatever, we'd, you know, be on Easy Street. So there's a lot of dreaming going on about this too, which, you know, I think the reality is something different.
Well, John, how does, from the lawyer side of this, I mean, again, this is one article, and the guy wrote this article early, and I'm sure that it's going to come out a lot different than this dude's writing in terms of who's getting paid what. It doesn't surprise me that if I had something to do with my name, image, and likeness, and if you want to go back, you know, 35 years, I mean, John's brother probably has a claim, you know, or they wouldn't let him be a you know, a flannel shirt, whatever, model for Kohl's during the summer when he was at Berkeley. You know, that was got to be in the 80s, right? Well, I mean, does the guy deserve a couple of hundred bucks if he was alive? Probably. But, I mean, that's what the Supreme Court opened up. I don't see them that this is opening up. How do you get from there? I think these articles are probably wrong, to just actually giving people back pay. That I don't think that's where they're going. The Supreme Court didn't say that.
Well, it's got, what, a 4% annual escalator clause in the payments? I don't know how they arrive. This is all part of the settlement negotiations, I'm sure.
Well, I mean, if you could have got a job and been an Olympic star in 2018, I mean, clearly there's some inflation involved with that, right?
Sure. And, you know, and it's probably more than 4%.
Yeah, but at least they got something.
But this is, you know, if you kind of pull back and think about the, you know, attractiveness of the college experience and the cost of the college experience and everything that goes with it, and we've talked about this a lot on the show and where this, you know, is headed, and I think that the colleges have benefited from the culture that says you have to go to college and you have to participate in all the things, and the place with the most amenities and, you know, the best sports programs, best dorm life, all these things that, you know, people never really, I don't think, cared all that much about. But the focus has definitely drifted in the other direction now, and I think that's peaked. And I see this now becoming a struggle for colleges to recruit students, let alone athletes. And when you've got that kind of, you know, direction, it's going to be hard to sustain big programs. And there'll be fewer programs, and they'll, as you say, there'll be less financial aid, and there'll be less building and less mid-level bloat. So I think you're seeing a real, you know, even without the House case, I think that the writing on the wall has been that the colleges have to do something else now to sustain whatever they are trying to do, and it's becoming impossible for some places.
Well, John,
you know, never were in the big leagues for sports or, you know, fancy campuses or near big city, you know, centers of population. They always had a tough time recruiting, and now it's showing in the closures and the shrinking of academic disciplines, and there's not enough sports enthusiasm to redeem that. So,
well, John, it's I mean, when you look at you know, that one of the, I guess, advantages and disadvantages of my education, which is quite a bit different than most of the other people on the show. I'm sure as hell not going to say better. I mean, I'm probably better off as an attorney than whatever, but certainly as an economist. I mean, I wasn't trained to be a trader or a money manager. I guess I was, because we were there when all the option theory was they were working through it. But what is your college education product? Okay, it's a higher level of education than high school, more specialized for some people. Necessarily, it's a bridge from 17 to 21 in a lot of ways. So what do you need? You need a place, you need a bunch of teachers, you need a bunch of students, and you need a few people in the administration, and that's basically it when you come right down to it. If somebody's just going to go, I want to learn economics, I want to learn engineering, okay, we'll get 10 people to teach engineering, we can have 20 people in a class, here's what they get paid, here's what you got to pay, plus a little extra for that. That's the basic bottom line. So then you get to a place, you know, like Notre Dame in our time, where all of a sudden they have this football tradition, starting with, you know, Newt Rockne, by the way. So all of a sudden you've got some people who clearly, in addition to going to school, are doing a bunch of other stuff, like getting their ass beat in practice and other things. And we say, you know, for what they're doing for the school, we're gonna grant them the admission or the price of tuition. Now, this all started long before anybody made any money in the NFL, right? I mean, there was no dough there. Dr. J's dad played tackle for Cal Berkeley, and he was one of the first big men, you know, in the game. He was a huge man. But he was in med school, and the coach said, his name was John, "John, when you can help us out, come on out to practice, and if you can make it on Saturday, if there's no labs, we could sure use you." He played most of the games. He probably showed up for half the practices, but he was still good enough to help him. Well, then he graduated. I think he was the same year as Frank Gifford. They were buddies. Frank Gifford made $7,000 his first year in the NFL. And John's dad said, "The hell with that. I'm going to be a surgeon," right? So all of a sudden, this explodes, right? And now the scholarships as the schools. I mean, our tuition senior year, for those of us that don't know, was $3,200, Jen, something along those lines.
Yep.
So it wasn't that big of a deal. Basketball guys might have got a ride. Nobody else got a ride. Lacrosse was a club team. Some of the hockey, what did the hockey guys get? Half a scholarship, maybe? Maybe a couple of them that were really good might have had a full ride.
Yeah.
But you're talking $3,200 in room and boards and other thousands. All right, so $4,200. We're not talking about giving anybody the keys to the city. So then it starts to be a little bit more money. You know, and there's always going to be people. Chuck Muncy, you know, lived in a beach house. O.J. Simpson, I'm sure, got money for Southern Cal. Southern Cal and some of the Pac-10 were really pretty good at giving people dough. You know, they were ahead of their time doing that. But I don't know that the normal tackle at Iowa ever got a whole bunch of scratch. He might have got something for a pizza or a beer from one of the alumni. But this thing starts to grow. And all of a sudden, the federal government gets involved. Okay, for every scholarship, which are now worth $50,000, you give a football player, you got to give a girl swimmer. Well, where's the revenue there exactly? Well, there isn't any. But you got to make this even. Well, she can't play football, you know. So all of a sudden, this thing now becomes this massive colossus. They have how many people are on scholarship that essentially the other students are now paying for. So now there's what, 500 people on scholarship at these schools? And there's still, you know, how many people were in a, there were 6,000 undergrads and we were there. So let's see, 1 out of 12 now is going for free. I'm supposed to pay for that? Why the hell am I paying for that? And now, by the way, Tom, your tuition in Jan is now not $3,400 next year. It's $4,400 or $4,800 because we're paying for all these other people. I don't give a crap about the girls' swimmer or the guys' soccer team or the guys' lacrosse team. Let them go play like a club sport.
And we're not the only ones who can read these smoke signals, Tom, believe
yeah.
me. And so, I mean, parents and students are onto this now, too. So
we're like, yeah, I'll go to a baseball game, but why does a lacrosse guy need a scholarship? He just wants to play lacrosse. I saw my first lacrosse game. It's a great game. I wish I knew how to play it. I'm not going to go pay to watch it. It's like, I wouldn't go pay to watch a handball game, even though I played 4 days a week for half my life. I mean, you know, does this have to be free? I mean, what are we talking here? Now that it's $70,000 and not free? I mean, be careful where you go economically. I mean, I'm going to say, John, if I were to write the ticket here, I'd say there's going to be 24 or 35 or 40 professional-sponsored football and maybe basketball programs, and the rest of them, there's no scholarships whatsoever. Screw it. Why should there be? Why do I... And I might care about the girl swimmer or the guy's lacrosse player. Why do I care if a guy goes to school for free when I'm paying for it? I don't want any part of that. Our problem is nobody can afford $75,000, and that's why the education system is going down a rat hole. That's why people are having debates. So why should you go to college? If it was $10,000, John, there wouldn't be a debate, would there?
No. And this you know, there's no way they can adapt to those changes in their minds without, you know, trying to suck up more money and give more financial aid and get some kind of, you know, star player on some sport nobody ever heard of and hope to make a few bucks on it. And that's just, you know, that's just chasing, you know, rainbows. That is not really sustainable. It's not going to, you know, fix whatever fiscal problems these places have. And I see this now as, you know, I think the enthusiasm has really begun to die off. And I just this is not the time that, you know, I think universities should be thinking about, you know, how can we expand our, you know, athletics, you know, expenditure as a draw, because we need to make money somehow or other because our budget now is so out of whack. We've got, you know, partnerships with corporations, foreign governments, everything else, and it still isn't enough. So
it's not enough because they spend it. It's not for profit. They just piss it away.
There's a profligate with it, and there's no real accountability. Nobody ever, takes a hit, you know, unless there's a huge, you know, fiscal embarrassment, and that's enough to lose your accreditation and everything else. Nobody wants to go down that road. But I think it will be, like you say, there's going to be some kind of sponsorship, some sort of, you know, advertising agreement where the you know, a company, a sports, you know, memorabilia, gambling, clothing, whatever, is the sponsor for this team, and you're, you know, going out on the field to serve a couple masters here, and in the long run, it's who's really going to benefit? I don't think the universities are really going to be the primary beneficiary of it, and I think, you know, the fans are going to have to step up to the plate and, you know, make bigger contributions or the alumni, and I just don't see that kind of climate now. So,
well, John, have you ever heard of I don't know how much marketing you took. Did you ever hear of a concept called the wheel of retailing?
I've heard of it, but I never took marketing class, so you've got to enlighten me.
This is assuming things are, quote, competitive, okay? Where it'll be, Jan and I look at, let's say Binny's or something. Beautiful stores, all kinds of stuff, and we say, screw that. We're not going to ship stuff to people's houses. We're not going to do anything. We're just going to buy cases of beer, cases of booze, cases of wine, and we're just going to drop them on the floor, sort of like the VIN or used to be the wine discount place. And you walk in, and we're going to have just the brands on there and grab it yourself. By the way, you'll pack it up yourself, and you're out the door. Well, there's going to be a price for that. And over a period of time, people are going to come in and say, boy, I really wish you guys had these on a shelf. To dig it off the ground. You know, and all of a sudden, we start spiffing up the stores. Now it's going to cost us a little more. We have people to help you out. We have all this stuff going. And finally, the point where we've got to raise our prices, and now we're delivering it for you for free. We're doing all kinds of stuff, which costs. Not saying it's bad. It just costs. And all of a sudden, you get a guy like Andrew who says, hey, these guys are getting a little fat and happy. How about I open up a joint down the block where I'm putting the crap on the floor in the boxes and everything else? It's called the wheel. As you get better, you move up the chain, you get more sophisticated, your costs go up, and then somebody else undercuts you. Well, that doesn't really happen in college, but you would think, Jan, it's somewhere in this beautiful city that used to be Chicago, or used to be beautiful city called Chicago, somebody, and they're doing some of it at St. Xavier's, and then you've got the Moraine Valley or somebody like that. Somebody's just going to get one of these campuses and go, you know, I can pop out a real serious engineering degree for $10,000 a year. I'm going to hire four or five people that were engineers for these companies and blah, blah, blah. And maybe we're going to start out with civil and electric, and we'll move into aerospace. We won't do aerospace for a while because we don't have those kind of guys. And we can do this for $10,000-$12,000 a year. And by the way, we're not going to have any guidance counselors here. We don't have a dorm here. If you commute over, if you got a mental problem, go to hell home and find your own doctor. We're not doing any of that crap. We're just going to teach engineering, we're going to teach accounting, and we're going to teach marketing and maybe some whatever. We're going to have two or three majors. That's it. Now, maybe we can't get accredited because the other guys control the accreditation. Let's absolve all that. What's the base cost for pumping out a serious engineering degree where I can go to some firm and say, hey, I'm an engineer and a guy believes it and I know what I'm doing, or I know accounting, or I know marketing, or I know something. I'm going to say, but now, how many more guidance counselors do they have at Notre Dame than when we were there? Who gives a crap? If you got a guidance problem, go home. Right? I mean, right?
Yeah. Talk about mid-level blows.
Yeah. But I'm not saying, you know, is it nice? Yeah. I mean, look at the some of these schools are $15,000-$20,000 now in room and board. When we showed up, you had chicken, you had mystery meat, and you had some potatoes, like it or lump it. We all survived. Now you go there, but we'll go there this weekend, there's the taco bar, there's the ice cream bar, there's the Mexican bar, there's the salad bar. Who the hell needs, if you want to pay for it, Jan. I mean, but it shouldn't be part of what I call education, should it?
No. I mean, the time you're spending on deciding which meal you want today or which ethnicity you want to sample, I think that time could be better spent doing anything else.
Well, I mean, but
like reading a book, maybe, you know.
Yeah, well, but it just grows. I mean, the joke at Notre Dame was they were still using this is no BS. They were still using the Army cots that they got from the Navy in World War II up until but first of all, they're steel; they never wear out, do they?
No,
they're going to last eight generations.
So I never remember one collapsing either.
No,
I didn't hear about it.
But you had a bunk bed, or you could take them off and have two beds, right? They would stack. So now all of a sudden, you know, so the last reunion, Audrey comes with, you know, and the cans are down the hall. You had a sink in the room, and her first question is, "I'm paying what for this?" You know, you know, I'm sending my daughter. She got to go down the hall to use the bathroom, and oh, by the way. Well, now, okay, all of a sudden, they haven't done much there, but some of these places, like a Northwestern on State Street, they're a serious apartment where two people
share. Combined living, you know, with a central kitchen, a central bathroom, and, people who have, private spaces of their own to get away from everybody else, but it's like living in an apartment, you know, so.
Well, I'm saying, if you're going to charge somebody $10,000, it better not be on an Army cot, and literally the blankets were from 1942. Right, they were Army blankets.
Right,
and
of course they don't have to charge that much.
Right, but they do until finally you say
that's all they offer.
Yeah, now I'm saying I'm paying what for what. So now all of a sudden it's all spruced up, and people say, well, of course now it costs this much. Well, because it probably does. Right, but it's not the same price.
This amenities race where it never used to be. I don't remember people even just when you buy like college guides where it give you a little snapshot of campus and tell you about its history and enrollment and college life and stuff. I remember looking at these things when I was in high school, and I don't remember anybody talking about the posh facilities, the comfort level of living in university housing, wherever it was. And I'm sure there were places that were more comfortable than others, but this, I don't think, entered into too many people's calculus for where they decided to go. And now it's a big deal.
Well, yeah. I mean...
And I think that's unfortunate because that's a race nobody really wants to win, because there's not enough money in the world to keep that kind of appetite satisfied. If that's all you're pitching, in addition to whatever disciplines you have in the academic side, but if you're trying to play a game, we want to have the most comfortable accommodations possible. That's just there's no ceiling on that, and that's not the way to go. Clearly,
but
that's the way they're going.
But now you end up with. If you and I were to do that, we end up like essentially John Marshall, which, a lot of really brilliant people went through John Marshall Law. Yet, if we were to have this, the John and Chief Engineering School, where Tilden Tech used to be, or CVS or someplace, all of a sudden, can they get accredited? Well, that'll be a fight for how long? I mean, because the other places have to accredit you, right? So can you really get accredited? Is a firm going to, like my buddy Bill Murphy tells me, if you hire a kid from Harvard, even if he's a blithering idiot, you probably get away with on his first day charging $4 an hour for the guy. You know, if you do somebody from John Marshall, you might have a stretch with that, even though the kid from John Marshall might be way better at what you're asking him to do than the kid from Harvard. I mean, it all of a sudden the selection process becomes, you know, all part of the money. Now, will some firm take three engineering, civil engineering firms out of our place and put them on working on the, you know, the next Dan Ryan redo or the next L you know, bridge or something? I'd say if we do a good job, why not? But yet, now, how long is it going to take for those guys to be considered the same as Illinois or Purdue? Maybe their teachers are even better. Who knows? Or as good. Yet now you got to fight that battle. Now it's reputation. Now it's accrediting. It's all that kind of crap, right?
Right. Well, just to take the John Marshall example for a second, that's a school, I mean, I've said this before on the show, that should have closed. But, you know, U of I saw an opportunity to get a law school in Chicago, which it really didn't need. There aren't enough openings in law schools to be filled today because the prospects for a decent job as a lawyer aren't what they used to be. So the gloss is off of that.
But it's still really hard to get in Chicago or Northwestern or Michigan or something, isn't it?
Yeah, but, I mean, U of I has a law school in Champaign.
Okay.
You know, it didn't need one here. Northern Illinois has a law school. I mean, the way they were trumpeting it was, U of I should have the Chicago presence, and I would say, what the blank for? But now you've got, you know, they took over John Marshall. It's now the university's law school. They assume the pension liabilities for those employees because now they're in the state university system, which they weren't before. And all of this is this grab to keep growing this beast. And again, it's there's no reason why there should be a law school like John Marshall when it couldn't keep going on its own.
Well, John, when you say that, was that COVID issues, or it seems to me there's a huge
declining enrollment, and you know they'd overexpanded, they'd taken over all this real estate downtown. Why, I don't know. Almost, you know, half of that block.
Well, John, there's still a big
very modest.
Isn't there still a big demand for essentially night law school though? Or isn't there?
But you know, other places have night divisions, and there wasn't enough demand to justify keeping John Marshall open. That's really my point, I think.
So those guys were all going to Kent, or?
Well, you know, DePaul, Northwestern, Loyola. You know, there's too many law schools as it is, Tom.
Okay, I could go at night to Loyola. I didn't know that. I thought.
Yeah,
that
I did, and I went days at DePaul and then transferred into the night division. For my last couple of years, and that was a it's a very busy time in my life, but it was a good experience. And you can still do that, and you know any law school that wants students will provide a night division if you're lucky enough to have a job. You can juggle it with your family's schedule and everything. They don't want to lose those students, but there weren't enough applicants to keep John Marshall going for what they were charging. And, you know, it was all to support this physical plant that they should never have expanded to that size to begin with. I don't know, you know, like this is, again, this expansion, this growth model that for them seemed to be the path of success, and it was just the path to bankruptcy. And then U of I comes in and bails them out, and now the taxpayer's on the book. So I don't see that as...
You know, yeah, but Jen, what about the collateral damage? All those guys that get done with law school at 10 o'clock and the train wasn't until 10:55 and they'd stop at the Skyride for two beers on the way to the train. What does it do to the Skyride?
Well, I mean, they probably still have a night division there. I did it in several bars, Tom. After class was over at 9 o'clock, that didn't mean I went straight home. Even though I had to get up at 6 o'clock the next morning, that never stopped me.
Oh, no, collateral damage. You got to be careful. Got to be careful on that. Oh, God. S&P futures down 37. NASDAQ futures down 151. Be right back. Stacks and Jacks.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are, or what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. Right here, right now.
Low OPEC stocks and jocks. I'm Tom Andrew on the board. SP futures down 40 now. NASDAQ futures down 161. Again, we had a nasty auction yesterday. We got the Dow down 230 in the 10-year. The 10-year was up a chunk, and now it's up again this morning. It's 4.57, which it hasn't been for a while. Over in Asia, we've got the Japanese market down 298.8%. We've got the Hang Seng down 344, 1.8%. Boy, 19,000, just a memory, 18,477. Shanghai up a point, so let's call that one unchanged. It's kind of odd. Over in Europe, with the DAX down 167, 18,510. We've got the FTSE down 32, that's 0.4%. CAC around down 102, that's 1.3%. Yesterday, odd day. We were up most of the day. Then we had the auction came out, the Treasury auction, which was a clunk. Then we went down and we came flying back on the close, but the Dow is still down 216. S&P's up 1, NASDAQ up 99, mostly because of NVIDIA. Bonds, I think I'm wrong on this. CNBC is wrong on this Japan number, I think. Where the U.S. is up another 3 basis points, 4.69. The Bund up 5 basis points, 2.64. These guys got Japan up 1.12 to 220. I think they are at 1.12, which is still, you know, a 10-year high or 12-year high. It's a lot. But it's not 2.2, I don't believe, even though they say it is, and they haven't taken it off their site. Oil up 57 cents, 80.40, finally over 80, not finally, but recently. It has been struggling to stay over 80. The Saudis and OPEC is claiming they're going to keep their cuts in place. We'll see if that happens. Brent up 55 cents, 84.77. Natural gas down 5 cents, 2.54. RBOB unchanged, 2.51. We've got gold, which had a huge rally yesterday, down 14 bucks today, 23.65, but still above 23.50, knocking a little bit on a 2,400 number. Silver down 4 cents after a 4% move to the upside yesterday, 32.09. Copper down 6 cents, 4.79. We've got U.S. dollar pretty much same spot, 108.5 against the euro, and we've got 107.5 against the British pound. We've got crypto down 652, 67,636 on the Bitcoin, so under 70,000 now for a little while. Andrew, what do you got for us, Travis Weather Sports? I think the Sox had a rain delay, and then they came back, and the game only lasted like another 10 minutes or 12 minutes or something bizarre like that.
Yeah, it wasn't much there. See, it is 7:39 here in Chicago on Wednesday, May 29th. And yep, getting right into sports, just that baseball there. The Cubs won over the Brewers 6-3. And even after that whole rain delay, the White Sox lost to the Blue Jays 7-2. And the Diamondbacks also lost to the Rangers 2-4. Over to Chicago weather, we are currently at, let's see here, 57 degrees. We have mostly cloudy skies. That's going to stick around a majority of the day. It might get a little bit clearer as things go on. We're going to have a high of 62, and that's going to hit around 5 p.m. Over in Phoenix, they're currently at 76 degrees, sunny skies. That's going to stick around all day, and they're going to have a high of 101 around 6 p.m. Now, finally, for Chicago traffic, things have definitely built, traffic is built on the inbound expressways. Only one accident to report, that is on the left shoulder of the Stevenson going north at Cicero Avenue. Causing a little bit of delays there. If you're on the outbound, same as our first hour, you only really have to worry about the Eisenhower. Things have built up near Austin Boulevard. Other than that, not too much to report on traffic, so that's all I got. Back to you, Chief.
The kid the Cubs had yesterday, the pitcher, he didn't even get the win, which is even more bizarre. He had a no-hitter through 7 or 8 or something. Joe Brown, let me get the guy's name here. He was really impressive. I mean, as in, like, really impressive. I'll try and get the... You watch any of the game, John? You're more of a Sox fan, right, which is hard to be these days.
Yeah, and I'm not much of one of those either.
No, this kid, let's see what he did. He had pitching. Ben Brown, 7 innings pitched, 0 hits, 0 runs, 0 earned runs, Two walks, 10 strikeouts. Wow. That's a number. And the kid's got a sweeping curveball that just, he's fun to watch. I mean, and of course, they got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 other guys. There you go. The guy on Milwaukee was almost as good. He lasted 5.5 and 5 2/3. So, anywho, it was kind of fun to watch that one guy. But Cubs are pretty bad, though. They got people that can't hit. I think their catchers, up until last night, John, they played, that was their record, 28-27. So that's, what, 55 games? I think that the catcher spot has only given them 30 or 35 hits total. That's not even hit a game, for God's sake.
No.
I mean, that's pretty awful. The one guy is batting, I don't know what Gomes at least has a little bit of power, but the other guy's batting, let's see, Amaya is batting average 193 and Gomes is 167. Ouch. How do you do that? It's like one a week? What'd the guy say in the natural? Flanagan just got his annual hit or something along those lines. God.
You'd be optimistic, Tom, when you use the name Flanagan.
Yeah. John, let's shift gears off the college stuff. We kind of beat that to death, although this is going to keep going. We're trying to figure out who's getting paid what, and we'll see where this all lands. I think if I was trying to get my daughter a college scholarship for swimming, I'd probably lay off that a little bit right now. What do you think? I'm just saying.
I would, yeah.
Or my son for something esoteric. What's going on? I saw something yesterday, and you were kind enough to do some research on it. Regarding the some foreclosure, some building in foreclosure here, which I think these apartment buildings are fairly full, Jen. That's what I read anyway. Anyway, the place in foreclosure, and as a way to get out of foreclosure, they ceded a big chunk of property next to it that they own to the lender. Or is that?
This is NEMA was the developer. This building opened in 2019, 78 stories. I think it's the biggest all residential property in Chicago.
No, it's not condo. It's rental. It's not condo.
It's rental. Yeah, and it's 1210 South Indiana. So it's kind of the north end of the Central Station development that now runs south along that area. It's been tremendously built up. But this, I looked at the documentation and the records, and there hasn't been a foreclosure action filed. At least, you know, this been recorded in the records so that you can track it. But there's a number of parcels that were part of the original project, and I think there's a piece of land, I believe it's south of where the building stands, that the owner had, you know, purchased and financed with the rest of the site, and the idea was to develop it in the future. I'm not sure if it was for parking or for retail or exactly what, but that piece has been, you know, handed over to the lender, which is a Mexican bank or finance company in Bursa that has the mortgage on it. And so this may be a way of the lender saying, you know, if you're not going to, if the loan is in arrears and you're not performing on it, then we need something to, you know, cut our losses. We're not, if this thing drags out, you know, into a several year long foreclosure action. So this is like a deed in lieu of foreclosure for a piece of the tract. And the same thing has happened with the Palmer House, Tom. The Palmer House has been in foreclosure since COVID, and the hospital is still, the hotel is still up and running. And I was in there last week when a friend was in town for a conference, the American Literature Association. And, you know, the lobby was full of people, all these academics. You know, they have a bar set up now in the lobby, which they never used to have the last time I was there. And you have the impression, gee, this hotel looks like it's kind of in pretty good shape. But the foreclosure drags on, and all of the commercial space in the Palmer House, you know, the storefront places that surround the core of the building, have been handed over to the lender. The lender has actually seized them.
Jim, what is the Palmer House? Obviously, is an old line place, gorgeous place. When they became the Palmer House Hilton, What does that mean? I mean, the Hilton's not on the hook for the building, or are they? Is it a separate franchise? I mean,
I believe it's separate ownership. The umbrella the Hilton name on it. I don't know exactly how it's structured. Once, you know, remember there used to be Albert Pick, and there were other Hyatt too, hotel chains, and they acquired occasionally, flagship hotels that they could add to their portfolio, and they had certain standards that they wanted, the hotels to live up to. But ownership wise and financing wise, I think they're on separate deals in a way. I mean, it isn't like.
So I just pick up their reservation system, their name, their something, something, but it's still my building, whoever owns the Palmer.
Yeah, and there's some, for advertising and for referrals or whatever, probably pricing and everything else, there's certain things that, Hilton hotels do. And they, it's I think similar to a franchise operation. I need to do more research on this because I'm not completely sure, but the financing and everything is certainly standalone for this, and the Hilton Palmer House is on the hook for it, and that may mean that Hilton will eventually have to cough up something, or if the building is handed over to the lender, they'll take a hit on it financially.
Well, Jan, what was the? I seem to remember at one point. This is dating myself here, but Marina City went into some kind of a, it went condo, right?
Yeah, back in the 70s, 78, 79.
So that piece of the building was, I'll use the term, okay, yet the rest of the place, the bowling alley, the restaurant, the parking garage, all the other stuff was in deep doo-doo, and they were in foreclosure, and it got to the point where even though you had a place to park, you drove in there, the parking lot wasn't even like lit at night because they were cutting back on the electric bills, and maybe the elevators didn't work or something crazy like that, even though the condominium, it was essentially became a split ownership, didn't it, of some kind?
Yeah, and that was the attraction initially of Marina City, was that it was residential, had parking, there was dock space for your boat, you could go right on the Chicago River and into the lake. You had a theater, all these things that were restaurants. This was the attraction that Bertrand Goldberg used again in River City and South Wells there. So the concept was, it's kind of like the idea of a shopping mall to bring people back downtown, and you can satisfy all of your entertainment needs and your residential needs and parking needs in a single complex. But when the condominium was created, condominium involves a three-dimensional survey of a piece of land, and it's by elevation, and space between the walls of apartments is owned in common by everybody who owns an apartment in it, and there's often properties that are just completely excluded from the condominium development entirely, which is the case with Marina City and its commercial spaces. So, and 20 North Wacker Drive, the old Kemper Insurance building, is the same way. Lyric Opera bought the stage, the rehearsal space, the fly space, the theater, the lobby, dressing rooms, all that stuff, when the building was condominiumized. So they own a piece of airspace in that, and the rest of the building is a functioning office building, more or less, these days. But that's a completely separate entity, and it's got its own separate financing, its own separate management, everything. And that means that sometimes things survive and make money, and other things flounder and go into default. So that's kind of where any condo project is, especially one like Marina City that had lots of things going on that condo owners wanted to have close by, but they didn't necessarily want to have to foot the bill for with their apartment and the property taxes. That was for some other developer.
Yeah, it was. It didn't go so hot when that place was going belly up, though. The other part, when you're parking your car in the dark.
Right, and this is the problem, I think, with condo projects, of a certain kind, that they gave the illusion that you could have a financially secure way of life, even though the building had other things around it, amenities that were detached from your ownership. But of course, once things start to go south and the building becomes less attractive because these commercial spaces don't function anymore, that drives away new buyers and reduces the value of the apartments. So the whole thing sinks or swims together, despite...
Well, Jan, a lot of this stuff, these real estate ventures, I mean, they're pretty competitive, when people are bidding for them and so forth, and even building them. And they're all... I mean, I always, I suppose I get like a broken record, because I don't even know what that means anymore. I keep talking about the risks associated with these things and how you have to, I mean, that's, you know, what I did for 5 years before I became a trader, is you do this sensitivity analysis on this stuff. And it's really hard to do when you're talking about these projects this big. What if the Fed does it? And that's why whenever I hear anybody of any age say, well, you don't have to worry about that, the Fed's going to do this, and I start to shake, physically start to shake of how stone cold ignorant that statement is, that you don't have to worry. You got to worry about everything, John. I mean,
yeah.
And the place that Robin and I, Robin, the dear departed Robin, who died earlier, well, pretty much the last day of last year, a good friend, she was a fixture on the show for a while. Anyway, she and I did some condominium projects together, and one of the competitors, when John's talking about his Lake Point Tower, I told a bit of story about that place. In order to be a condominium, you have to own the property. Well, if you look at Navy Pier, now it's a big, you know, tourist attraction slash trap, right next to it is Lake Point Tower. It's a massive place. Well, you might ask yourself, gee, when Navy Pier was actually a pier, how did people get goods off the pier to the rest of the city? Well, the answer would be there was a railroad there. And the railroad went right underneath, which is now, or right through, which is now the downstairs of Lake Point Tower. And the railroad went to, and there was a bridge across the river that serviced Tribune Tower with the printings, the paper for the printing and all that stuff, serviced all those Sun-Times building. There was a railroad down there, and there's still a bridge. Okay. Well, so Indiana, Lake Point Tower was built on Indiana air rights on the Indiana Harbor Belt, right, Jen?
Mm-hmm.
So they could,
yeah.
They had like two or three groups of owners that wanted to turn it condominium. Thought they had the political muscle to change the law, and they never did. So finally, they get to this Greek outfit. Was it Galitas? Was the people ran it?
American Avesco?
Yeah. That? Somehow or another, they had the political whatever. They stuffed enough checks in the right pocket to where they went condo, correct? But nobody else could. Anyway, those guys were. They were one of the biggest condo developers, and one of the other ones was an outfit called Bruni. So Robin and I bought this condo up on, was right off the lake. I forget the name of the street. It was one of those big courtyard buildings. Yeah, it was a beautiful apartment right at the end of the courtyard. You could buy it either totally remodeled or not remodeled. And they had one that they had already taken the thing apart inside. And I said, how about giving me that one for the same price as not remodeled, and I'll just finish it. They hemmed and hawed, and they said, okay. So they essentially did all the destruction work on the third floor, which would have been really something for me to try and do myself, even with her help. So I got all that was done. We were down to the studs, so I could just start, you know. So we did that for 6 months. Well, this outfit Bruni was so well run. And they would buy one of these places. They would never even think of buying the next one until the one they had was like 85% sold. They were very conservative in that industry. So they were growing, but not near as fast as some of the other people, right? So I buy this place. The first weekend, they sell out like 50% of all the units. Next weekend, another 8%. Well, I've told this story before. Between the time Robin and I bought the place, I think it was in November, and the next June, interest rates went from 8% to 14%. So these guys, over the next couple of weeks, saw another place that was just perfect, and they couldn't resist. They bought the other place. They didn't sell another unit for 6 months after selling 60% of them out in probably 3 weeks.
Oh, yeah, I remember.
And they went belly up. They went belly up because the other place, they just got destroyed on because they didn't have, this one wasn't sold enough to carry the other place. They had a big loan, and interest rates stayed up for a while. They ended up going out of business. Now, did anybody think that in 6 months your rates were going to go up 6%? No. But don't ever think stuff can't happen, right? Right, Jen? I mean, stuff, you know, bleep happens. I mean, it does.
Yeah, if you compare the condo conversion market pre-1980 to, it was like, post-1981, you wouldn't think you were in the same solar system.
Right, and it was only a couple years difference.
Yeah.
And you know, and I like right now people will say, what if, you know, what if... the Fed wants to raise rates. Well, there'll be a quarter point. John, they were going up a point every 2 weeks, weren't they?
Yeah.
There's no law that says you only do a quarter point or a half a point every 2 months or every month and a half whenever they have these meetings. I mean, if this 10-year rate I don't think it's going to. I sure as hell hope it doesn't. If it wants to go to 8 or 9% because, you know, China doesn't show up for an auction or everybody decides the inflation rate's too high, it's going to go there on its own. It's not going to wait for Powell to give a speech, is it? I mean, like I say, I'm not predicting that, or, and I sure as hell hope it doesn't happen. But if it does, there's nobody going to be in the way. Who's going to stand up in front of that one?
No.
What do you make of this is not your field, I know, but you have a general common sense about you. What do you think about these other countries? I mean, as bad as we are, which is pretty awful. A Japan public debt is estimated to be approximately $9.2 trillion, which is 1.30. How much is a quadrillion? At 4 trillion? Quadrillion? Good lord.
Yeah.
That's a lot. It's 263% of the GDP, the highest of any developed nation, and 43.3% of this debt is held by the Bank of Japan. So in other words, 43% of it they printed money and bought it themselves.
Right.
What the bleep? How do you work your way out of that?
It's utterly insane, Tom. I mean, and of course, again, you know, a central bank can allow that to happen and keep the game going for a while anyway. But it's hardly something you would ever suspect would be a model for anybody else, and it's something you'd like to avoid, you would think.
It's
Japan looks, you know, prosperous too. I mean, compared to a lot of other places, but this shows just how easily you can mask all the rot underneath, and that's, you know, I think we're kind of in that same boat. The percentage is nothing like that when it comes to GDP versus the deficit, but I just think we're trying to beat that game somehow, and of course it's a game you don't want to play and you can't win.
Well, they're talking about, well, their interest rates are actually very low, so their percent of their interest. Here's two charts here. I got to turn my head on sideways to read the damn things. Japan has the highest percentage of GDP in terms of government debt. This is now 2017, so this is old. Second was Greece. Third was Italy. Is it Portugal? France is there, and Belgium, and they go down the list. Who's OCOD? Who the hell is that? Australia. The U.S. is about 120. I mean, now the U.S. is higher than that now. Actually, the U.S. was like 90, but now they're... But now we're higher than that now. We're what, 110, 115, 120? So it is certainly going a lot higher to the point where, you know, what is the number? What can you... So Japan, they own their own debt. Okay, I'm going to put this out there, but I'm going to buy it. That's the only way you keep interest rates at 1% when your inflation rate is wherever. I mean, my buddy, you know, John Lee, was in Tokyo a couple weeks ago. He's going to come on the show maybe next week and talk about it. He was there, he was in Singapore, and he was Hong Kong. He said in Japan, all he does is bitch about they haven't gotten a raise in 10 years and the inflation is through the roof. I mean, this is what we're doing. I think regular people, Jan, have a feeling they're being taken. They just don't know how at this point. I mean, and there's people that I, you know, in my family that are brilliant people. Not about brilliant, but smart. And they'll say, what are you talking about? The inflation rate's only 20%. Everybody in auto industry is getting a 20% raise. What's the problem? I go, well, first of all, they're getting 20 to 24% raise over 5 years. And inflation's been like 40% over the last 3 years. So where's the catch-up? Why do you say 40%? The government says 20. Why don't you believe anything? John, I used to believe everything. I don't anymore. I mean, is that me having a problem, or is this stuff unbelievable?
No, I really think we're at this... poised at this you know, kind of critical moment, Tom, where everybody's talking about, you know, the restaurant industry, you know, contracting, and even the fast food places are having to slash their prices to get people to come back, and that I think shows that people's buying power for this kind of product is exhausted, and they can't justify doing this as often or ever again with those prices. And of course, the more of these places that will close, and I'm sure there will be tons of closures of fast food places and low-end dining experiences, that's going to throw a ton of people out of work. And, you know, and there aren't going to be enough jobs to absorb that in the industry that formerly employed them. So these people are going to have to reinvent, you know, their resume somehow and find some way of you know, making ends meet, or there'll be, you know, massive dislocations, people filing bankruptcies and defaulting on mortgages and everything else. I just see this as, you know, I think there has been a tipping point that we've reached in the past, and nobody really wants to think about how bad it could get, and they prefer not to talk about it. But I hear it from people all the time, you know, going into places and there's nobody there, and you just get this depressing feeling that, that somehow this business is on its way out, and it's only a matter of time before it closes its doors, and it's happening.
John, what are you, I mean, not today, I know how marketing goes. Well, this used to be, it used to be a sexist comment. I mean, but it's probably not anymore because the guys are just as, I used to buy my, when I used to wear suits every day, right? I used to buy them at a place down on Canal Street called Benjamin's. It was on Clinton. You ever, remember that place?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they had the world's best stuff. Anyway, it was always, you know, very well priced. Plus, I always needed, you know, tall or an extra tall, which I couldn't really get at Fields or someplace, so I had to go there. And they had, like, one price. And I go, do you ever have any sales? He goes, no, this isn't like a ladies' place where you double the price and then say 50% off and everybody's happy. But if, when you talk about these chains, all of a sudden these huge price, Janet, the stuff's doubled in the last 4 years. Now they're cutting it back 20%, and they're giving you a, they're doing you a favor.
Yeah,
I mean, come on.
I'm not impressed.
No, I mean, it's the. What did somebody tell me that they the other day that they went and got a Big Mac fries and a Coke? It was like $12 or, you know, some $11. If it wasn't already made, they would have said keep it. I mean, you can go to a restaurant and get it for that. Sit down and have somebody wait on you.
Yeah, I mean, the last couple McDonald's I've been in is, you know, kiosk ordering. So, you know, you type, you know, whatever your order is, you put in your credit card, you get a receipt, you take a little number and put it on your, wherever you're sitting, and somebody, you know, brings your meal out to you. But I think, well, here's a couple jobs they don't have to pay people for anymore.
Well, John, I'm not so sure
they're
how
still
this...
charging you an arm and a leg. So.
I'm not sure. I mean, Andrew might know how this new tip bill landed, but I was talking to a guy last night who's run many restaurants. In one of the restaurants, you order your hamburgers, like, over the counter, then you sit down at the tables. And he said, we'll never design a place like that again, because if the person serves you behind the counter, the minimum wage is 15, right, or 12 or something. But if a person comes at a table, and if it's considered a tip job, it's $7.50, then the people make up the difference. So you don't ever want to be in a place where you hand out stuff from behind the counter. You want people to be served. And I thought that evened up somehow in the last 6 months, or didn't it?
Well, I mean, I've seen that too, where they charge you the tip at the cash register, but you're not getting your food then, and somebody else has to come out with it. Somebody has to pull off whatever other job they're doing. If it's slow, they take them off the cash register, and they bust the food around. But the tip is going to be included before you leave the cash register.
So. Ah. Well, so the real quick, Jan, we only got a, well, we actually don't have hardly any time, but what is the downtown real estate stuff? Is it reaching a bottom to where people might even think about investing, or are we still in free fall? We don't know where it's going to land.
I think we don't know how far it can go. And you take a building like the 1210 South Indiana one, unless they get, you know, the street crime under control at that area, you know, it's a hopping place where you got the L line and the subway and bus line and museum campus walking distance, a ton of activity there. But, you know, the retail establishments are getting robbed and shoplifted left and right, and people assaulted on the street. I don't care what kind of rents they want to charge at a building like 1210 Indiana.
But yeah, I'm not so sure that I would feel comfortable getting off the Roosevelt State Street stop there at 10 at night and walking over to Michigan Avenue.
Yeah, I avoid that area after
dark. That's a little lively. I mean, it's not like the Armitage stuff.
I feel too exposed, and there's too much stuff I can't, like, keep track of around me, and it's a very intimidating experience. So.
Hey, on that note, Jen, talk to you on Friday, and I'll see you on Friday.
Friday and through the weekend.
Yeah, we're gonna be the latecomers, so that's okay. Everybody's trying to lobby us to go to the football coach's speech. I think I'm out on that, but so are you. But we'll have a nice time. We'll just dodge the other guys and the stuff we don't want to do.
We'll find something.
SP Futures down 41. NASDAQ Futures down to 169. Not looking good here. We'll talk about it tomorrow morning. Stocks and Jocks.
That's all, folks.